Hikatra Podcast Conversations for the Curious Essential Knowledge Simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of Hikatra AI. Welcome to the deep dive. Okay, so today we're tackling something most of us probably don't think much about, but it shapes, well, everything we read from other cultures.
That's right, translation.
Exactly. And we usually think, you know, the translator's job is just be invisible, like a perfect mirror for the original book.
Uh-huh. Just move the words over, no fuss.
Right. Simple, mechanical, maybe even a bit boring.
Well, that's the exact assumption we want to kind of dismantle today.
Okay.
We're diving into the work of Matthew Reynolds. He's written quite a bit on this, and his whole argument is that translation isn't just transporting meaning, it's actually a transformation. A really vibrant, creative, cultural transformation.
So the translator isn't just a servant copying things down. They're more like an artist.
Precisely. A high artist, even. Reynolds really pushes this idea, looking at works like a creative transformation of meaning and his very short introduction to translation.
And he argues that maybe what we think of as mistakes or, you know, things lost in translation, maybe that's not loss at all.
Sometimes it's the opposite. It can be the source of creativity, of something new emerging. He talks about this idea of creative betrayal, which sounds controversial, but...
But maybe it's essential. Like, we need that betrayal to really get world literature, to understand how ideas travel and change.
That's the core idea we're exploring today. It really reframes the whole thing.
Okay, so tell us about Matthew Reynolds himself. What makes his perspective on this so unique?
Well, he's got this really interesting background. He's a professor at Oxford, English and Comparative Literature, so he definitely knows the theory side.
Right, the academic chops.
But crucially, he's also a translator himself. He works with Italian, French, German, bringing them into English.
So he's actually done it. He knows the messy reality, not just the theory.
Exactly. He bridges that gap between, you know, the abstract ideas and the actual practical struggle of finding the right word, the right rhythm. That gives his arguments a lot more, well, weight. He feels the tension.
Okay, so let's get into that main argument then.
Yeah.
His central thesis. You mentioned he challenges this idea of a perfect copy.
Yeah, he calls it the myth of equivalence. It's this belief, maybe unconscious, that somewhere out there, the perfect translation exists.
Like an ideal form.
Kind of, yeah. And that the translator's job is just to find it, to be that invisible window pane between the original author and us.
But Reynolds says that's impossible.
Fundamentally impossible, because no two languages slice up the world in the same way. Think about it. Every word isn't just its dictionary definition.
Right. It carries baggage, history, culture, sound.
All of that, a whole cloud of associations. So when a translator takes a text, say, from Japanese into English, they're immediately hit with choices. Impossible choices, really. Well, do you stick rigidly to the literal meaning? Or do you try to capture the original's rhythm? What about the tone? Is it formal, informal, ironic? And the cultural references, do you explain them? Find an equivalent.
You can't do all of those things perfectly at the same time.
You just can't. Something has to give. And that's where the myth part comes in. The perfect, all-encompassing translation just doesn't exist.
Okay, I can see the impossibility part. But when he talks about creative betrayal, that still sounds a bit risky, like an excuse for just messing it up. How do we know if it's a good betrayal, a creative choice, versus just, well, a bad translation?
That's a really important question, and it's kind of the crux of it. Reynolds would argue the difference is about intention and effect.
Okay.
A bad translation might just be unintentional. Maybe the translator lacked skill or didn't understand a nuance. But a good translation, a creative one, recognizes the impossibility of perfection. It knows it can't replicate everything.
So it makes conscious choices.
Exactly. It consciously decides, okay, to make this powerful in English, I need to prioritize the rhythm here, even if I lose a bit of the literal sense. Or I need to find a cultural equivalent for this reference, even if it's not a direct match.
So the impossibility isn't a flaw, it's the engine. It forces the creativity.
That's it. It's the constraint that necessitates the translator becoming an artist, a co-creator.
Right. So the best translations aren't invisible mirrors. They're actually new works of art in their own right. They have to be.
They have to be. And they creatively adapt to the source. The classic example everyone points to is Edward Fitzgerald's version of the Rubaiyat of Omar Khayyam.
Ah, yes, from the 19th century, translating 11th century Persian poetry.
And Fitzgerald. Well, he wasn't doing a word-for-word job. Not even close, really.
What did he do then?
He took huge liberties. He reshaped the structure, changed the quatrains. He injected this kind of melancholy, questioning tone that really resonated with Victorian England.
So it wasn't strictly faithful in a literal sense.
No, but it captured a spirit. And his version became this massive literary sensation. For many in the West, Fitzgerald's version is the Rubaiyat. Its influence arguably overshadowed the original Persian text globally for a long time.
That's a powerful example of the translator as a collaborator, across centuries even, creating something both old and new.
Exactly. Something faithful in spirit, yet totally original in its expression.
Okay, so we see the translator as an artist, but Reynolds also talks about the politics of translation, right?
Yeah.
When these choices aren't just about poetry, but about power and governance.
Absolutely. That's a crucial dimension. He dedicates a whole chapter to it, hammering home the point that translation is never neutral. It's always tangled up in power dynamics, cultural biases, political contexts.
And the example he uses for this, it's pretty stark. The Treaty of Waitangi.
It's probably one of the most devastating examples you could find. It shows how translation choices can have immediate, profound, and frankly, catastrophic historical impacts.
This was the treaty in New Zealand, 1840, between the British and Maori chiefs.
That's the one. It was meant to establish, you know, a framework for them to coexist. But the whole agreement hinged on the translation of a couple of key terms.
And those terms ended up meaning very different things in English versus Maori.
Dramatically different things, with huge implications. In the English version, the text stated that the Maori chiefs ceded sovereignty, complete authority, to the British crown.
Okay, pretty unambiguous in English.
Right. But the Maori version used the word kawanatanga. Now, this word was actually derived from the English word governor. It was a transliteration.
So not a traditional Maori concept.
No. And its meaning was closer to governance or administration, maybe implying shared power, practical management, but definitely not the absolute surrender of their ultimate authority, their Tino Rangatiratanga.
Wow. So one side thought they were handing over total control. The other thought they were agreeing to some form of shared rule or British administration alongside their own authority.
Precisely. That single translation choice, or perhaps ambiguity, whether intentional or not, framed the entire relationship differently. And the fallout from that linguistic mismatch, that translation failure, well, it led to immense conflict, land loss, injustice, issues that are still being grappled with in New Zealand today.
It's a chilling reminder of how much power is embedded in language, and specifically in the act of translating crucial terms. Politics and translation are inseparable.
Undeniably. And if you scale that up, you start to see how translation doesn't just shape specific political events, it shapes our entire understanding of history and culture. Which brings us to another big idea. What makes a book a classic?
We usually think of a classic, like Homer's Odyssey or something, as this fixed monument, right? The original text sitting there unchanging through time.
But Reynolds flips that completely. He argues a text only becomes a classic, only stays alive, because it gets translated again and again.
Translation isn't decay, it's life support.
Or more than that, he calls it the adventurous afterlife of the original. Think about it. If the Odyssey only existed in ancient Greek, it would be a relic for specialists. It wouldn't be a living part of world culture.
It survives because every generation, or even multiple translators within a generation, creates a new version, a new interpretation.
Exactly. Each translation is a performance, tailored, consciously or unconsciously, to its own time and audience. Compare Alexander Pope's translation of Homer from the 18th century.
Right. Very formal, elegant, lots of rhyming couplets. Very 18th century.
Very 18th century.
Ooh.
It tells you as much about Pope's era and its ideals of poetry as it does about Homer. Then you jump to, say, Emily Wilson's recent translation.
Which is much more direct, plain spoken, focuses on different aspects of the text.
Totally different feel. It uses modern language, makes different choices about characterization. It brings Homer closer to a 21st century reader in a completely different way.
So the classic isn't static. It's this core text that keeps generating new interpretations, new performances through translation.
That's how it stays relevant. It's constantly being remade, kept alive and new by translators. Each version gives us a different lens, adding layers to our understanding.
And Reynolds takes this idea of translation even further, doesn't he?
Yeah.
He says it's not just for literature or treaties. It's everywhere.
Yeah, he emphasizes its ubiquity. He suggests, quite persuasively, I think, that we are all translators, Pretty much all the time.
How so?
Well, think about explaining a complicated idea from your field of work to someone who knows nothing about it.
Okay, yeah, you have to simplify, find analogies.
For translating, you're taking specialized language and concepts and rendering them into a different framework for a different audience, or summarizing a story someone told you, you choose what's important, what to leave out, how to frame it.
That's translation too.
That cognitive work is translation, even reading Shakespeare, arguably. You're taking early modern English with its different vocabulary and sentence structures and mentally translating it into your contemporary understanding.
Huh. I never thought of it like that. It's a basic human cognitive process, not just some fancy literary thing.
That's his point. It's fundamental.
Okay, this connects really well to the idea of the translator as an artist, especially with poetry. Because poetry seems like the ultimate challenge, right?
Absolutely. It's where the translator has to be most creative, most willing to make radical choices.
Because you're dealing with sound, rhythm, meter, puns, layers of meaning. Things that just don't line up between languages.
Exactly. You often have to sacrifice the literal dictionary meaning of a word entirely to save, say, the rhyme scheme or the sonic effect. You can't replicate the exact sound of a word like murmur in another language.
So the translator has to find a word in their language that creates a similar feeling or effect, even if the meaning is different.
Precisely. They have to create an equivalent experience, which demands immense artistry. It really reinforces Reynolds' big idea. The best translations are always also original works of literature. They simply have to be, especially with poetry.
And this idea of living between languages, making these constant choices, it must connect deeply to personal identity, too, especially for people who are bilingual or multilingual.
Oh, definitely. Reynolds talks about that in-betweenness, living and thinking across multiple linguistic and cultural systems as a kind of lived translation. Your identity itself is shaped by navigating these different worlds.
Is there an example he uses for that?
A really fascinating one is Samuel Beckett.
The playwright, Waiting for Godot.
That's him. He wrote in both French and English. And interestingly, he often translated his own works between the two languages.
He translated himself. Why? Wouldn't he just write a new version if he wanted in the other language?
It was more than just creating a version. It was part of his creative process. It was a tool for rewriting, for achieving a certain stylistic effect.
Okay, slow down on that. What kind of effect? Why French specifically? He was Irish, right? English was his first language.
Right. And he felt English came with too much baggage, too many ingrained literary habits, cultural echoes, maybe emotional resonances he wanted to escape.
Too much noise.
Kind of. French, for him, was an adopted language. He felt he could write in it more simply, more logically, with less style, almost. More austerity.
It's like it gave him a critical distance from his own thoughts or feelings.
Exactly. A stylistic distance. So he'd write something in French, achieving this pared-down, minimalist style. Then translating it back into English was like, well, like translating someone else's work.
Ah, so he could be more objective.
Yeah.
More ruthless in cutting things.
Precisely. It helped him maintain that stark simplicity, that slightly detached mathematical quality that became his signature style. His identity as that specific kind of writer was forged in that process of self-translation.
That's absolutely fascinating. The act of translation shaping the author's own voice.
Yeah.
Okay, so we've covered the theory, the politics, the literary history, even identity. Let's bring it back to the listener. Why should, you know, someone listening right now care deeply about translation theory? What are the practical takeaways?
Well, there are a couple of really important ones. First, just for how you read. Reynolds basically encourages you to be a more sophisticated reader. When you pick up a translated book, don't just assume you're getting the original. Recognize you're reading an interpretation, a work of art created by the translator in collaboration with the original author.
So don't treat it like a transparent window.
Exactly. And even better, if you can compare different translations of the same book, you'll suddenly see the choices, the different angles, the ways the text can live. It gives you a much richer kind of 3D understanding.
That makes sense. And beyond reading literature, what about just navigating the world?
This is crucial for being, you know, a responsible global citizen. It means developing more cultural empathy and critically evaluating the information you get.
How so?
Ask questions. When you read a news report about events in another country, ask, who translated this? Was it translated from speech or a written report? What cultural assumptions might be baked into the English version?
Like the Treaty Waitangi example, being aware of those Kawanatunga moments, those small word choices that can have huge implications.
Absolutely. Being aware that translation choices frame reality, it makes you a more critical consumer of media and hopefully more empathetic to different perspectives.
Okay, and one last big piece. The future. Technology. Google Translate. AI. Are human translators going extinct?
Ah, the big question. Reynolds definitely addresses machine translation, MT.
Is it game over?
Not quite. He acknowledges MT is, well, incredibly useful for certain things, getting the gist of an email, basic travel phrases, low-stakes stuff where good enough is fine.
Functional communication.
Right. But Reynolds is pretty firm in predicting that the really important work of translation, the stuff that requires deep cultural understanding, ethical judgment, capturing irony, poetic nuance, historical weight,
The art.
the art, exactly, that will remain profoundly human. Machines can crunch data and match patterns, but they don't understand context, subtext, or human experience in the same way.
So it's not replacement, maybe partnership.
That seems to be his prediction. A future where technology handles the grunt work, the efficiency, but human creativity, human judgment, human interpretation provides the crucial final step. The ethical and aesthetic choices remain with us.
That feels right. Okay, so wrapping this up, what's the big single takeaway from Reynolds' work on translation?
I think it's fundamentally about liberation. It's liberating us from that tyranny of the perfect copy, the myth of equivalence.
Stop searching for the impossible ideal.
Yeah. And instead, embrace the richness that comes from multiple interpretations. See the original text not as a perfect finished thing, but as a starting point.
A starting point for that adventurous afterlife.
Exactly. Every translation adds a new facet, a new perspective. It's about celebrating that multiplicity, not mourning some imaginary loss.
Yeah.
From the political choices in Waitangi to the stylistic choices of Beckett, each interpretation deepens our understanding.
I really like that reframing. It makes translation feel much more dynamic and exciting. Okay, let me leave you, our listener, with a final thought to chew on, building on something Reynolds observes. He says, "We live in a translated world, but we pretend we don't." Think about that in your own life. How often do misunderstandings happen? Maybe at work with colleagues from different backgrounds, or even at home with family. How many of those little conflicts or miscommunications are basically translation failures?
Failures to translate between two people's internal languages, their assumptions, their experiences.
Exactly. Maybe every conversation we have is, in a small way, an act of translation, trying to bridge the gap between one mind and another. Something to think about.
Definitely something to think about.
See you next time with another remarkable thinker. Another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Ekatra Foundation.